you got any coffee? I'm
going to fix Rick up with a sandwich and he brought us some avocados for me.
Not quite right. Yes, it is. Nice as yesterday, anyway.
See, I'm still not hay with it.
Not.
Not exactly.
I don't know what's happened to the sunshine. You see, you cut on the hay, it looks like this would be a good time to cut it down out there. No trouble. And, we won't be here. That's the trouble with it, that burn stuff. And once you bale it, and it's got too much moisture, you know what happens?
It rots.
It gets hot inside and steamy.
When you move it, it looks like smoke.
Isn't it possible for it to catch fire?
Yeah, in a close place.
Does it melt it down and spoil?
What doesn't it do?
Everything.
Doesn't
make
it
mold, spoil, burns, yeah. Turns to dust.
Turns to dust, that's right. It sweats, it heats so much. And the next thing is smoking, and the next thing you know, it's pottery. And then you might as well throw it away.
Then you go out and you bust the bales open and scat them and rebuild it.
Oh, that's early. That's Ford. You know, you can do that before.
Now, do we have your telephone number that makes good hay and weekend? You'll get a call.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'll give you my phone number.
It'll be all right next weekend, I think. Rick, let me tell you.
I'll be up here in 2 weekends. So I have a cousin that's graduating.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not
going to
help us with hay with
new
graduation.
That's like Rick's letter. Save the hay for me.
Your outdoor voice.
Huh?
Outdoor voice. Your outdoor voice.
My outdoor voice.
That's it.
That's good.
Let me tell you. We framed you last time. Didn't do it on purpose. But we were so interested in getting in getting a lowdown on these big chain supermarkets. We didn't give him a chance, you see. And I must say, it's just fascinating. I nobody ever tells me about those things. You see, when your daddy was here that morning, they had to rush off. If he had put in a half hour here, he could have given me enough.
He would have been
information.
My mom. Oh, he'll sit and talk to you.
Well, bring him with you. And you go on about your business and leave him over here.
I don't know if that'll work.
Well, don't Ahab on the quarter day. Suzanne, what's the first time we told you to? When Annie was here, wasn't it? She wouldn't go. And Suzanne came and said she won't go. So Suzanne, just get her out.
Don't say she won't go, just go. This little old negro woman was in here. She wouldn't do anything we wanted her to do. She wouldn't talk. She wouldn't move. And Guy said, Suzanne, get her out. She won't go. Well, take her out.
Just get her out.
And one of your friends was here. Who was it? Was here.
Carol was
Carol
here.
Carol was here, and Carol took her down to the comedians. She said she never made such conversation in all her life, keeping Annie out of the kitchen.
She was a drawback. We couldn't get anywhere for Annie. Miss Annie. And she got one of those beautiful old sing-song voices. Just beautiful. She'll use it. She's spoiled. We didn't give you a chance yet. Last time we held you down to the chain store. Tell us about your business down there. I don't mean your business, you know.
The chain stores?
I don't know. You just, what you got into. What you seen down there. She hadn't heard you talk to her, you see, and Suzanne hadn't either.
You haven't heard me talk.
And I didn't give her, I mean, they didn't hear you talking, and I didn't give you a chance, Faye and I didn't.
Miami's hard to talk about. I haven't been there in, it's been 2 years since I've been back yet. And I've been working.
Yeah.
See, I've seen the city like I haven't seen it before. You know how you live in New York and you never go see the Statue of Liberty. I live in Miami, I never saw Miami. But now I've been driving all over Miami.
Yes.
For like the last 5 weeks. I've been everywhere in Miami.
Yeah.
And it's like just a bunch of little cities within that city. That's the funny thing about Miami. There's no one thing you can say is Miami. It's little towns. It's the Cuban area, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you go downtown and you look for somebody to speak English. You know, the shops have signs, "We speak English here." Well, that's nice.
Yeah.
And
that's just one part of Miami.
Yeah, that's a little part, but I really like that section. When I worked among the Cuban people there, you know, everybody's speaking Spanish. I don't understand a word they're saying.
Yeah.
But it's not like a foreign language. It's like someone's talking in the next room and just can't quite understand what they're saying.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking, why can't I understand what's wrong?
Yeah.
But the people are so friendly. And of course, I had a Cuban salesman I worked with, and he opened things up quite a bit. So.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, because he knows the customs, and then he knows our customs, so he's in between the two, which kind of helped. And it was really interesting, because when he talked to me in English, he'd use one tone of voice. But now, when you talk to the Cubans, the tone of voice changes. It's just a different way of approaching people, you know. It's a different kind of personal relationship in that voice.
Yeah.
And really fascinating. So I guess that's why it didn't sound like a foreign language, because you could just understand something just by the way they were talking, the intonation in their voice. I'm really fascinated with that. And then if you go up to the northern area, that's it's mostly Jewish there.
Well, now the Cubans, he got a different feeling in his voice. For them,
mm-hmm.
It was
it seemed like it was colder, you know, like it was a little more blunt. But I don't think it was really, because the Cubans are really close in their family,
yeah.
Really, really close family relationships. And this lasts almost all their lives, even after the children have grown up. You know, the families still get together, and they like to do that in America. You break up. Families break up. You go off to college and trying to get out of the house and everything, but the Cubans don't. They, you know, stay together. It's really nice. And that's why their grocery stores, I guess, are small. Little family shops. Everybody comes in and drinks Cuban coffee. I was sitting here drinking Cuban coffee with all of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's where I like stuff, too. It's strong.
Yeah. You don't have to drink so much of it.
Well, I didn't drink that much. Well, some of them drink 7-8 cups a day. That's like just eating a pound of Maxwell's coffee dry.
That's good for your liver.
Do something to you. But I enjoyed working that area, because you just felt like you're around friendly people. When you went up in the northern area, it was more higher class. People made more money there, and it was mostly a Jewish area. It was all money. There was no people.
Even the stores.
Oh.
That's what you're talking about.
Yeah, and you run into a lot of old couples, and all they do is bitch at each other. Just come in and yell at each other all the way to the store, all the way down the aisle, back up again, out to go. Just yelling and yelling and yelling. And you just sit there.
Not self-conscious at all.
No. As loud as they can be.
Yeah.
You go over Miami Beach, and that's the way it is. Just bitching each other down the street. And I think they're really doing it because there must be people around. They want them to hear. You know, I'm mad at my husband, and listen to me. Ah, they start yelling at their husband.
Well, I didn't realize that.
They're always making jokes on Jewish people. I don't like to, you know, to cut them or anything because they're Jewish, but it gets to be so funny. I'm telling you, such a deal you got here. And you just, oh no.
That's right. I'll interject a story. I was talking to, I lived in a predominantly Jewish suburb of Boston, and when I was got locked out of my apartment one afternoon, and so I went next door, and there was a woman sitting in front of the building, and I was just in the sun in the afternoon. I asked her if I could use her phone, and she said sure. So I went in, and I was going to call and tell my roommate that I was locked out, and please to hurry home, because I didn't want to sit on the doorstep for too long. And so the woman got to talking to me, and I told her I was from Florida, and I was going to be going back down to Florida, and she said, oh, you're from Miami. And I said, no, I wasn't. I was from Gainesville. And she said, Gainesville. Oh, well, I don't know the suburbs too well, but I go to, I go to Miami Beach every summer. Well, I just don't try to tell her. Gainesville isn't really a suburb. They just consider all of Florida a suburb of Miami. Yeah. But there's no other part. Everybody does, really. In Boston, you know, yeah. All that's in Florida is Miami.
And here we are.
And I've never been to Miami in my life, and I was born in Florida, and no one can believe that, you know.
I think it's very fortunate.
I've never been to South Florida at all.
I went there to the hospital and to the United States Army. So I had good reason to go.
Good place to go in Miami is the airport.
Yeah.
That's Miami.
Yeah.
I just go sit up in the international airport where departures and sit there. And at Christmas time, it's just solid people wall to wall. I just sit and watch them. Just amazement.
Yeah.
Just little families here and there, little groups of people. And the clothes they wear, oh, it's so funny. Because I get off the plane from New York, and they are dressed for the worst snowfall you can imagine. We'll have like 70 degree weather. And I come off that plane, and you look at them, oh no. And I'll be sitting there, you may be dressed in jeans, something very casual, and these people will be really dressed up, sequin dresses, evening gowns. And you can't understand this, because you know they're going to step outside and they're doing construction and it's dirty and it's raining. And hop in the cab and go to Miami Beach, run inside another building. They never get out of buildings. They're all in buildings all the time. They never see Miami.
Yeah. But the Cubans see Miami.
Yeah.
They're outdoor people.
Yeah. See, the thing, I used to go bicycle riding early in the morning when there wasn't too much traffic, if that's possible in Miami. And we used to could tell what kind of area we're in by the amount of people that were up. See, if you were in a rich area at 8 o'clock, there's no sound, there's no light, there's no nothing. Everybody's asleep. When you hit the Cuban district, where they've been up for 2-3 hours, everything's live. And people are moving around, you know, all the newspapers are out of the yard, everything. And they're up and they're working. And they're thriving people there. The salesman, he talked with me, and the Cuban salesman says, "Now, Reek, you have to be careful of the Cuban Jew. He's terrible." He was so funny.
You don't see much of the salesman. You just work with them.
Yeah, off and on. I work with them. I worked with Manny for 1 week, and then I worked with another guy for just a day or two, and then I'll work by myself or something. We might meet in a store and work for a store for a couple hours and split up and go to another store. It's about the only place I really got to meeting was at a business meeting we had. The old smoke-filled room thing. And they get in there, it's going to be a short meeting, and 2 hours later, you're sitting there. What happened to the short meeting? It was also typical, because one boss would say something, the other boss would repeat it. And then he'd say something, and he'd repeat it again. I just sat there for 2 hours. Why are you repeating everything?
You can't turn it loose, can
you? No. And the guy that was repeating everything was head of everybody. He was the number one man. And all he did was repeat things. And I thought,
oh, really?
I guess that's why you're in that position.
Let's see, who was some little salesman people? God's sake. And the store managers and all.
Oh, store managers, yeah. Well, you know, the old store managers that have been with the company are the ones I like, because, well, some of them get to be where, like, they're part of their store. They're really proud of it. And then some of them just don't give a damn about the store, and they're the ones that are easy to get along with. But you meet a couple that are in the grocery business to work with people, to sell to people. See, people are their game. And the store is just a device for doing it. See, and so they're not too proud of their store, that it gets in their way, or that they get mad if someone does something in the store. But, you know, they still have enough pride to keep the store up and keep it nice. So those are the ones I like Mr. Steele, the manager I work for. I think he had his own store in Kentucky, see, a little store. And he was still that way in this chain store. He ran it the way he wanted it run. And when he left, everybody just said, how does he do this? You couldn't figure out his books. You couldn't figure out his system. You couldn't figure out anything. And for 2 weeks, he says, oh, please come back from vacation. But then I go into some stores and have really
and
young...
Fan.
No, he worked for Quick Check.
Quick Check.
Yeah, that's Winn-Dixie. That's what my dad works for.
Oh, Quick Check is Winn-Dixie?
Yeah.
Why do they have different names? Now, you see, that's what we got him off on last time. He didn't have a chance.
Well, when...
Don't answer it.
Anyway, Winn and Dixie were two men that founded the company somewhere along the way. Or they were chain they merged with. And Quick Check is just a name. See? Like, just a catchy name.
But the same thing.
Yeah. I think they're trying to get them all the same name so people will realize that. But this... some of the store managers, the real young ones, are afraid of their job, and they won't talk to you. They're real cold. Everything is order books and company policy. And you can just tell they're afraid, and they won't talk to you.
Now, in what capacity are you talking about now?
These store managers, these young guys.
Talking to you as a...
As a salesman, or just as customers. They're afraid of customers. You see, they're young, and they're not sure of themselves.
Oh.
And like Mr. Steele, just walk up and talk to somebody. He'd follow them all around the aisles, all around the store. And I told you my mom finally quit shopping there because he talked to her so much that she couldn't get her shopping done. And these young managers won't do that. And the store is cold, and the employees are in a little clique by themselves. And where I worked, oh, I got to know all kinds of customers, you know. You'd have regular customers, and they came through the line. You'd go over and bag their groceries, and everybody knew that you were the one that did their order. That was the way it was. And they'd have their own cashier they'd go to.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. It was pretty personalized. But in some of these other stores, you don't see that.
They can't quite...
They're not... It's just a job. It's just something to make money. And there's no interest in the people. And if you don't show an interest in the people, they're not going to come back to the store. That's the only thing that really brought them in. And if it was sales that brought them in, that's the kind of customer I didn't want, because they always argue with you, make you mad.
Argue with you about, you mean when you pay or something?
Yeah, they like want more than they were allowed to have on sales. They'd have maybe a limit. And if they have a big order, I'd usually give them one or two extra or something, depending. But every once in a while, they just make me mad, and someone would come through. And I'd just be in a contrary mood, and I wouldn't give it to them. And I'd
oh, you're talking about back when you were...
That's when I was cashier.
Cashier?
Yeah.
You cashiered.
Oh, yeah. I was almost assistant manager, except that I was part-time, so they couldn't let me have that job.
Is that right?
Yeah. I was in there for about 3 years.
You mean you could punch those things?
Oh, yeah.
They come out right, huh?
Well, close enough. I think $600 disappeared from my register one day and they never found it. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't my fault. I said, I don't know where it's gone. It's up to you, but don't look at me, because my dad works for this company. I wouldn't steal for myself. So, cashier was interesting, because you could ring up an order without ever looking at the person. You know, all you have to do is look at the groceries and the money. Goodbye. You know, never look at it. Or you just get to talk to them. And she had to be good, that way, you know, you didn't have to look at the keys.
Do two things at once, like Mr. Weaver cutting hair.
Yeah,
I don't know Mr. Weaver.
That's her friend.
I'd be a little afraid of somebody cutting my hair and not looking. But, you know, the way I got to run the register really well was I realized that that customer has just got an eagle eye on that register, and he's watching every price. So I never worried about my mistake, because I knew if I made one, they'd catch it. So I just sit there and talk to them. I wouldn't look at what I was doing. And I make a mistake.
That's right. Jim's mother does that. I can see her. She stands up there at that counter, and she has her hands on her purse. She watches every move that cashier makes.
I'm so trusting it never occurred to me.
You mean now?
She doesn't like to go shopping by herself. She likes Faye to go along, so she can get in front of the basket. Faye can be unloading, and she can still watch the cashier ring it up. And she just plants herself, you know, with her purse on the edge, you know, and her hands on it, and watches the cashier. And she knows her prices, and she makes sure that's what goes up there.
Be surprised, housewives. They know their prices.
I've seen them with lit.
They've got
a little counter. Mm-hmm.
So
they memorize the prices. Boy, something changed. They let you know it. Why did this go out? I just work for the company. I don't make prices, lady. But I got to where I really felt insecure if they weren't watching me run the register, because I wasn't watching. I knew where the keys were, and I hit the right ones almost all the time. But every once in a while, I'd go for the $1, and I hit the $10 one. And the bill would come up, and it'd be about $50, and I'd look at it, and I'd look at the customer, and I'd go, I think I made a mistake. You know, and you look at the bill, and there's a couple items for $10 that are supposed to be 10 cents, and whoops.
That would attract trade.
Yeah. But you know, when you make a big mistake, that was fine. I always hoped when I made a mistake it was going to be big.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
Because
that would be
awesome. Yeah, and they knew you weren't trying to cheat them, and you could laugh at it. But a little mistake, they could manage them. But that's the way I ran it. Just now I could talk to the customer.
Yeah.
It was real nice.
Now you see, I think that'd be remarkable, just to have some way of seeing. You see, you just go in the supermarket, you don't know what goes on. You know, I don't see a thing. I just mad whenever they change where the soap is, or put the counters a little different. You know, where you have to make an extra loop. Now that's all I see. And that's sad.
You ought to go at different times, because you have different kind of people at every different time of the day.
I wouldn't see it.
At 9 in the morning, you have the world's most efficient housewives.
Dare you make you run.
You can't get the door open fast enough at 9 o'clock.
Oh, really?
Well, you get that door open, and if you don't get out of the way, they run you over. Boom! They grab their baskets, run through the store, get everything they want. Just like that. Mm. And you run to the register and ring them up. And then that slows down and gets pretty dull during the day, during the weekdays. And then come 4 o'clock, let's say on Thursday or Friday, it's mostly families that start shopping. They're, you know, families that enjoy shopping, go out and shop together and have a good time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But then late at night, you have the people that are running out of cigarettes and beer. And then on Sunday,
I forgot to take meat out of the freezer.
Yeah.
And Sundays were the worst. I'd only work Sundays when if you really had to have somebody work, no one was around, I'd go in and work.
Yeah.
But I hated Sundays because they were the meanest people. They would they'd come in hungover, mad. They were the lowest class people you could find. It's like they kind of creeped out of the woodwork on Sunday. Just terrible. They'd buy a big order, and they were the ones that like have two or three times the limit on sales. And I'd just be contrary on Sundays. And I'd just ring up once, and I'd ring the rest at regular price. And I just knew, here it comes. Boom! That's on sale! And I go, Lemon woman, $5 order or more. Go talk to the manager. And the manager just looked at me, and I'd look at him, and he'd go, oh, go ahead. I'd ring it up regular price. Then they start saying, you haven't worked here very long, have you?
Say what?
You haven't worked here very long, have you? And I go, 3 years. I just, you know, you just get to the point you want to make somebody mad. Because they were being deceitful. If they said, look, I got a $20 order, I'd like to have 3 times the limit on the sale, I'd probably say, all right. But what they do is they put one at the front of the order, yeah, and one item at the back of the order. Yeah. And they figure you wouldn't remember it.
Why don't they get 3 baskets?
Oh, that's, they do.
That's my idea. You out. See, when I go with Faye sometimes, she could take a basket, I could take a basket.
Oh, they do. Have their neighbors buy it up. They'll come in with a receipt from another store and say, well, I just bought $20 worth of groceries, and I forgot the sale, and I say, that's a food fair receipt. This is a quick check. Oh, I had the wrong store. I'm sorry. And you go, uh-huh. And they're very deceitful, some of them. But that's mostly Sunday people. I never did like Sundays. But all you did on Sunday was stock the beer case.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. See, because they sold, Miami Springs, they would sell beer on Sundays. And most places they wouldn't. In Miami, so everybody would come to Miami Springs on Sunday and buy the beer and go out. But there was some strange people, the winos. We had a lot of winos used to come in. They were quiet, happy people because they were stewed all the time. But they used to get a bottle of Muscatel and go back in the bathroom and drink the whole thing.
Before they'd leave the store?
Right, just I'd be gone. I'd go back and clean the bathroom at night, and there's all these empty bottles. What is this?
Wow.
Couldn't believe it. We had one guy that came in every night. He was a barber, and he'd buy 2 bottles of Muscatel and a steak. And he'd go out, and there was a bus driver that always waited for him. You know. And if he was really pleasant, but if the bus started running late, then he'd get jittery, start getting mad. You know, it's just a fine edge there.
Sounds a little like O. Henry, doesn't it? He watched those things so much.
Just what you look at.
Well, that store was, you know, it was right by the airport. And you had, people from all over the world coming in. You'd have stewardesses, like they were Chinese. And they'd learn to speak English so they could fly, you know, to America. And I remember one time I was checking out, and like, I gave her the change. I knew she was foreign, but I, you know, didn't realize that this was probably the first time she'd been to America or something. Dime? You have dime? She had a handful of dimes. I said, yeah, you have a handful. Oh, those are dimes? I really got tickled over that.
Well, you see, the reporting is so much more interesting than the raw experience.
See, we're right there without having to be there.
I wonder, in talking to who saw all that, you know. You know, Faulkner didn't see it. He didn't see all of it, certainly. He reports on it just as if he was there. And I've heard Miss Daisy do the same thing. She's told about Miss Menifer's trouble with the rattlesnake and Buddy's trouble with the rattlesnake and she's been in many episodes where she wasn't. But you know, she has respect for sources, for bibliography. Somewhere along the line, she'll just with a little flick, put it in.
Mm-hmm. Putting it. Mm-hmm.
Just very inconspicuously. Stick it in. Isn't that right?
She's black and 70.
Now you see, the hard thing, though, for me to think of, Debbie, is that office job. How you'd have anything to tell your children about when you got
home. Not that much, that's why I left. Why do you think I left? You can only take it for so
long.
There's
bound to be some way of making something out of an office job, but I haven't, you know.
Well, not much. There are a lot of gray people. They just, you know, everybody. So many people have had the same jobs for 25 years in that hospital, and still there.
In your dorm room?
No, not where I was. No.
Where were you?
I was in the public relations office. But this was just people who worked in the hospital, you know, nurses and people who maintained the hospital, too.
Yeah.
Long time. We had an awards assembly every year, and we'd give out little pins. You know, people would get very angry if they didn't get their pin for having been there 6 years or something. I wouldn't want to go get it. I wouldn't want to be reminded I've been here that long.
And get invited to the dinner or something like that.
Oh, they had a club. If you'd been there 25 years, you could belong to the 25-year club. And we had to, for the banquet this year, we had to go around giving out, everybody got either a corsage or a boot in the ear, depending on whether you're a man or a woman. They gave a pin for every 5 years you'd been there, up to 25 years, and I guess after 25 years, you had to retire or something, I don't know. But they delivered all of them to our office, and we had to go around and give them out to everybody, because they thought this was the function of public relations. So we did that one whole day, spent going all over the hospital. It would be interesting, you know, if you were in medicine or something, and you were actually working with patients, but we didn't even work in the hospital. We were, you know, the neighborhood was more interesting than the hospital. They didn't have room for our office in the hospital, so they moved us to a hotel 3 blocks away. And it was the combat zone in Boston, which is
combat zone.
That's what they called it. It was where all the nightclubs were, and it was a really, really, it's a really bad neighborhood, you know. Cause
combat
zone.
After dark. Well, it wasn't too nice during the day either. And talk about winos. They come out in the summertime because in the wintertime it's too cold. I mean, I guess in Florida winos can be out all year, but they can't in Massachusetts because it's too cold. So what they do is they get in fights in about September, October, and they get put in jail for the winter for 6 months. And then they get out again in March. And then about March they start appearing again. And during the summer it's just incredible. They're, you know, 25 or 30 just drunks all over our neighborhood where I worked. You know, you'd walk to work and there'd be so many on the streets.
Henry's cop in the anthem.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The same thing. But they never bothered me at all. I mean, I didn't really mind. They were certainly happy. I mean, they didn't bother anybody, you know. They just drank wine all the time. I mean, other people might have, you know, made me afraid or something, but I was never afraid of the winos. You know, I always sort of felt I could just push them like that and they'd fall over if they came up to me or anything.
They ever bum money off you?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
I was in Gainesville. I was going to theater one night. I was in line, and this little old guy, you know, old gray hair guy, comes up, and he's bumming money for wine, so I gave him some. And, like, right away, he was like best of buddies or something. He starts telling me I used to be a boxer. Tell me all the people he's fighting. He starts dancing around and punching at me. I've got my hands up, you know, so he can punch my hands. And I said, he's like, what do I do with you?
Take him away.
That's why it was so funny. You give them money, it's like you're paying them off to leave you alone. And as soon as you get money, they'll want to start talking to you.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people beg in Boston. It's quite a lucrative business, I guess, not just winos, but in Cambridge, a lot of the students bag. All over the streets and everything. You go to the movies in Cambridge and there are all these kids panhandling in the movies. It's really I don't know, I didn't have too much sympathy for it. You know, these kids would come up and ask you for money, and they'd be wearing a $75 leather coat, you know, or something like that. I thought it was kind of ridiculous that they should be asking for money. But, and then, while there's a lot of communes that support themselves entirely by begging in Boston. I guess that you, the Buddhist...
Communes?
Yeah, the Buddhist, you know, the monks that wear their saffron robes, and they're down on the square in Gainesville now.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of...
Hare Krishna.
The Hare Krishna, yeah. There are a lot of them in Boston. And their whole communes, they all come out, the kids, the girls, men, and they all beg. It's a really accepted way of living.
I have communes, like a couple of them in Miami, but they're self-supporting.
Yeah, well, I think there are an awful lot of communes in the country in New England. You know, it's the big thing to do, too, is to move to Vermont or New Hampshire, Maine, and have a farm and, you know, live out and support yourself that way. But these are totally urban, and they support themselves just by begging.
Depressing, isn't it?
It is depressing.
Thought of it.
It's very depressing. Well, I found Cambridge very depressing, too. And I just never liked to go over there very much. To do anything, you know, because you were just sort of besieged by all these kids that just looked, well, to me, they looked all exactly the same. You know, I found Cambridge a very homogeneous place. People say it's so exciting to be around Harvard and everything. Well, I thought everybody was exactly the same. You couldn't tell who went to Harvard or who went to the high schools or who went, you know, who was teaching, who was a student, anything. Nobody looked different. Everybody looked the same.
College degrees are like everywhere, right?
Yeah, you know, and all the kids look exactly the same, just exactly. They all just wore a uniform. Well, here we sit in blue jeans, but you know, everybody wore blue jeans and handmade leather sandals and I don't know, all the same things. You know, the beads, leather jackets, wore their hair the same way. Talked about the same things. Nobody had anything different to say. I'm very glad I didn't live there.
There was a girl that was in several of my classes that went up to Boston when she graduated, and she was lucky. She got a job in Harvard Library. It pays very well. Because Boston is expensive to live in.
It is bad, yes.
And she went with several other girlfriends. And I think one of them is working in a Sheraton hotel as a maid. So out of the 10 maids there, 6 of them have their degrees, and the other 4 are working on them.
Yeah.
And then the other one's working in a mental hospital as an orderly, you know, changing bedpans, and she has her degree.
Yeah, well, one of my roommates has a master's in history and is a telephone operator. She couldn't get a job, so she's answering the phone in a paintbrush factory. But then she tells people she works in a paintbrush factory, and they always immediately think that she makes the paintbrushes. She knows a lot about paintbrushes. Do you know what a ferrule is on a paintbrush?
I have no idea.
So, wait a minute. Now, the ferrule is the metal part that goes around the wire, I mean around the bristles. That's the ferrule. That's the only part I can remember. There's the ferrule and the handle and the bristles.
I know the paintbrushes now, almost all of them are good ones, you know.
Not at this paintbrush factory.
They
supply Woolworths, and you know, have you ever been in Woolworths and seen the big baskets that say, you know, 10 cents an item? Well, that's the kind of paintbrushes they make there. They have pink and yellow bristles. They're just incredible. She used to bring some home every now and then. They make about 2 good kinds of brushes. But they don't make house painting brushes or anything like that. They're just inexpensive.
Oh, I see.
Woolworth brushes.
Woolworth brushes,
yeah.
You know, those sale items, I slip up on that all the time. They put on a sale, and they don't sell the regular stuff, they sell sale stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That is so hard for me to get in my mind. I wear shirts around here now that are too short for me, too tight for me, because I got 3 for $5 on sale at a high price. Those people, though, in the office, that's where your real work was.
Mm-hmm. And then,
Didn't get to see them much.
Well, when we were all in there together, we didn't talk about too much except what we were doing. You know,
yeah.
Carrying on the business of trying to project the medical center to Boston, which was rather hard to do because it wasn't really a medical center. It was the medical school and the dental school and the hospitals, and they all hated each other. And the medical school and the dental school were part of Tufts University, and they had to pay Tufts, you know, so much for maintaining them and everything. And then the hospitals were not doing so well. There were three hospitals. There were five units altogether. There were two schools and three hospitals. Well, the hospitals were all going broke about 5 years ago. They decided they'd get together and maybe they could make enough money to keep operating. So they made one hospital, but each hospital still had its own administrator who didn't want to give up running his hospital. So they all fought, and then they tried to make a whole medical center out of the two schools and the three hospitals, and they all five fought. And what they need to do is have one person run the whole thing, but they won't do that. They'll never do that. And so what we were trying to do was impossible because we were working for three people. Finally, they finally did get one person to run the hospitals, although they still fight a lot. There is one person who supposedly runs the three hospitals, but he now fights with the two deans, the dental dean and the medical dean, and they just—it's just silly to me. I mean, that's one of the reasons I left too.
You know, the only consolation I've ever found for that is that the Russians do the same thing.
Well, it's just so childish, the whole thing.
A lot of
big
frogs and a lot of small puddles.
It's just so childish that it should be so important to fight over such petty things.
But you didn't know this before you went.
That's right. It took about a year to figure it out, you know, to watch them operating.
You have to know those things, don't you?
Yes, it happens in everything. I know. I mean, it's nothing new.
Even in a department store, it happens between departments.
Sure, it happens in universities. People have power struggles too. I mean, any time you delegate a certain amount of responsibility to someone, I don't know why it happens to some people that they feel that they have to have more or something, but then they push other people down so they can have more, and it happens everywhere.
In the grocery stores. When you go and say, I'm going to reset your section, the stockman looks at you like, how dare you touch my section?
Oh,
they take it. Some of them, like 10 years, you know, stocking that section. They don't want you to touch it.
Yeah.
So I just pull out a letter and say, there's Mr. Miller's name. He's your boss. I got permission. And they'll just, well, don't give me any repacks. Make sure you put it all back on the shelf. Okay.
All right. Don't give me any repacks.
Yeah. See, sometime when you rearrange it, you won't have as many rows of some items, so you can't put it all back up. So I just repack it and put it in the back room.
Are you limited to just a certain amount of space?
Yeah. You work in a certain area. Mm-hmm. And, they don't like you to do that. Oh, they won't put it back in the back room. So we just stick it all here and there.
It's kind of like Melville in the South Seas when he first went, you know. He went to find Rousseau. He found, you know, that the natives couldn't walk except on the left foot and long hair and all like that. They were just one taboo after another. Far more than civilization. That must have been a blow. Right there in the beautiful beaches.
Yeah, I guess so.
So restricted.
Yeah. Well, you're out of a position of doubt. Let me tell you, now these people, they haven't heard. I heard that beautiful phrase, that little printer with his silk suit on.
Oh, yeah, Daddy. Bring him to life to us.
She don't know him personally, but she does. That's a glimpse, isn't it?
Uh-huh. Yeah. The printers that we used, I wrote a magazine for the medical school, and one of the printers that we used of several. And one of them was this little Italian named Carmen Napa.
Carmen.
You have to get the whole picture. He's sort of little. And he wears lifts in his shoes, so he'll be taller, and he wears shoulder pads, you know, down the front and down the side like this, so he's big like this. He's 35, and he lives at home with his two older brothers and his mother. And he lived with his mother until, I guess, this spring. And he finally moved out of the house, but where he moved, right around the corner from his mother, and he gets up and goes to her house for breakfast every morning. Oh, I just remembered one time he went to a dude ranch. That was his vacation. He and his two brothers went to a dude ranch and rode horses. I remembered that. He thought that was, he got tired of it after one day. But Carmen wore the most amazing clothes I have ever seen any man put on. I never saw him wear the same suit. And he had an uncle who was a tailor and would custom make his clothes with shoulder pants. And he used to wear electric blue suits and lime green, you know, and just incredible colors. I mean, he was just like a peacock with the colors, you know. And another one, and it, I think it was just something with printers, because another printer that we used to wear, well, he was limited to pink and blue. He used to wear pink shirts and blue. And baby blue and turquoise suits. Yeah, and this is just, it's just, I don't know whether it's just a part of the whole printing community in Boston or what, because I don't know any printers other than the ones that I worked with in Boston.
Can't you see Ben Franklin in a pink suit?
But Carmen's whole life revolved around his wardrobe, his mother, and his car. He had I think it was a Mercedes or something, but it had a bar in it and a phone. And he'd call us from on the road, and you always knew when Carmen was on the road because his voice would be scratchy, and you'd say, "Hi, Carmen, you in your car?" "Oh, yes, yes, I'm in my car today, on the road."
And he'd telephone you from his car.
Mm-hmm. He'd call us from his car, because he was never in his office if we called him and tried to get him in his office. He was always driving around in his car.
You know that automobile phone cost you.
Really?
Yes.
If you call in a car, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you pay him $50 a month, $100 a month for it.
Oh, you mean if you have the? I thought you meant if we called him in the car, we had to pay a charge for it.
Mm-hmm. I don't know about that.
Oh, no. Sure, it costs a lot.
It may be handled on that individual basis. I don't know. Well, now, you see, this is, Suzanne?
Oh, no.
Now, what, you see, let me tell you. Now, how would you see, he went up there and talked to his buddies, and all they did was talk about picture shows.
That's right.
All about salesmen in the abstract.
Yeah.
No experiences at all. Huh?
That's right.
What'd you talk about?
It's always trying to define, right?
Well, tell us what you talked about.
Last night?
Yeah.
I really don't remember.
Last morning.
Okay.
Well, I mean, you see, you've got time here. We're not pressing you. And you can pull out your experiences as long as you want to. Just the reporting is what I'm talking about. Help me out.
Usually when I'm with Tony, we start talking about books. Tony thinks he's Napoleon, see? And he's an incredible romantic, and he's always getting these books and reading me passage after passage from books.
Oh, really?
Especially Fitzgerald, stuff like that.
Oh, really?
Incredible romantic.
Well, can he bring it to life?
He does pretty good. He's a very animated kind of conversation. And it's a lot of fun to listen to Tony talk, because he's so funny.
Well, take one of the passages.
Better yet, tell him to help anybody he does in class. He was in a biology class. And he's the kind of guy that'll come out and just say what he thinks. Just come out and say it. And sometimes some of the things he said I wouldn't. And yet I'd really like to because it comes out so funny. But he was in a biology class. And he was really angry with the way the class was being taught because it was just memorize. And the teacher was yelling at him that they didn't think and all this. And so she got real mad one day. And she said, "You don't think. None of you think. Now does anybody in here think? You just don't think. What are your thoughts?" And so Tony's sitting in the back room and he kind of raises his hand, a little timid like, says, "Ask me what I think." And I go, "Oh no, Tony, you're not going." So she walks back, "Well, what do you think?" Well, when Tony's got something going, first thing he does is start packing up his books. So he's packing up his books. "Well, I think that what I'm going to do is go out and find me a phone booth and get the yellow pages, and I'm going to memorize one page of that, and that'll do me as much good as your course." And he picks up his books and walks out. And she was just, oh, "Your fault. You get an E. Don't come back to my class." He's always doing this.
Why, Rick?
Things like that happen.
Yeah, and he got an E. And I go, "Tony, you'll never get out of school." "Well, that's, I just had to do it." And he's all the time.
Memorize one page.
He's so funny.
Well, now, let me tell you. What I was saying about... See, I can't talk to you much about method because my object is so different from yours. My object, is, more or less, is to get things on tape. And that limits me a great deal. And you see, all my methods sort of focus in that direction,
mm-hmm.
like Miss Chitty. Publication, I'm not interested in, and I'm not interested in... saving humanity. I just want to get these on tape, largely because I like them. I'm very devoted to the people I talk to and wonder on tape. But see, that's not your object. So, some of these pauses, anybody could stick in a word they wanted to.
See, like, I guess for us, largely it's just the, you know, kind of ourselves looking at things, you know. We're not going to put ourselves down on tape, but, and we won't get a chance to put other people on tape, but that doesn't mean we can't, you know, look at people.
And I don't know. Have I have one sound object like with each person, too. I think you can have different objects with different experiences. Don't you think? I mean, depending on what the situation, you can have a different way of experiencing it or a different way of reporting it.
Well, the thing that concerns me is what I see. And I have blundered so much, you know, thought I had a bright idea, and it turned out to be just my undoing. Any time I get self-confident, I'm due for fall, just like Chaucer's monk story. Oh, yes. When I think I pretty well understand the way things are regulated, oh, I'm due for a tremendous fall.
That's so true. But you know, like with college, you're taught not to really look at something, but look into it or through it, and then go running for some motive. And it's so much psychology, motive and analysis. And just sitting around and talking, it just seems like a waste of time. And I know one of the things that really surprised me, so when I was studying Dr. Johnson, you know, I thought, well, this man must have really published a huge amount of work. And he didn't.
Yeah, yeah.
He sat and talked.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I couldn't understand, why did the man sit and talk?
Yeah.
And now I'm beginning to see, well, that's what you should do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I always thought, what a waste of time to see these people sitting on the porch talking. My grandmother's has a porch that goes about 3/4 of the way around. And when I was little, people all used to come over, sit on the porch at night and talk. And the big event of the day, of the night, was when the train came by. See?
Yeah.
And then they'd go get some homemade ice cream. We'd sit and eat ice cream. And I was little and I was bored, you know. I wanted to go run and play.
Yeah,
something.
Yeah.
And I couldn't imagine they sitting and talking. And as I got older, I got to enjoy it. You know, all these people come over and sit and talk.
Yeah.
But now most of them are gone, see. Don't have a chance to do that now.
Well, now, you talk to various objects, but as I look at it, it's recording the experience. That's basically informative.
Yeah.
There's no quipping in it, like there is in with the college students.
Yeah, you're always saying one thing and there's a lot of other things going on between the lines. And it gets very competitive. That's
yeah,
one thing I get
it's
so
not
tired of.
Mm-hmm.
You
there's
talk
no leisure.
At someone.
That's right. At leisure.
Always
no
fighting
leisure.
Them.
Yeah, you're always sitting there, you know, and everybody just waits for a chance to jump in. And,
wait for
you know,
that's the way it is a lot of my friends. just fighting like that. And you're the good friends with them, but you get so tired of it.
And you're competing all the time,
right.
Too.
Yeah, so you're matching experiences.
More than that, I think you're just trying to match intellectual power.
Yeah.
Just trying to beat them.
Yeah.
And you're not really looking at anything.
No, as a matter of fact, I have a friend of mine who's living in Tampa. Real good friend of mine. He's been a great influence in my life, especially in literature. And he was telling me the people he's living with, they have almost a point system. And like they'll be sitting with a group of people and the other person will say something. He'll go, 25 points. And it's funny, but it's also depressing that they're doing that.
Yeah.
You see? Because it's getting in the way of what you're doing.
I had a friend in medical school who wrote just sort of a sketch thing for, I helped them do their yearbook this year, and the fourth year medical students, and they all wrote articles. You know, one of them wrote an article about medical trivia, and after 4 years of medical school, you just are always trying to beat the other person out with trivia because they all know a lot. So you're just trying to beat them out and say, you know, which disease is it that causes the heart to enlarge? And, you know, what is this? And you get points for it was exactly the same thing. You get 25 points if you know this. And they keep running tallies to see who's winning on trivia that week. This medical school is terrifically competitive, too. That was my point.
There was,
that was a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
These people, friends of mine, live in Tampa. They had one guy, his name was Mick, and they used to call him the trivia toilet of Tampa, because Mick was the kind of guy that when he came over to your house, he'd pick up the almanac and start reading. And he just had just mountains of trivia in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the one I was telling you back that when he cooked one thing at a time. And like if he cooked spaghetti, which is about all he ever did cook, he put on the water and then he'd think, oh, I need noodles. So go out and buy noodles. Start cooking noodles. And what else do I need? I need sauce. So go out and buy one can of sauce. And then he'd say, well, I need two cans. So go out and buy another can. And I'm like, Nick, what are you doing? That's his mind, just one thing at a time. And he used to get the funniest things because he'd just give us this trivia. But everybody accepted that Mick was the one that did that, and nobody else competed with him there. And so we just let him have that area. And that's the way it divided up. Well, those guys lived together. Each one had an area they were strong in, and which was a kind of competition, because you just didn't infringe on Mick's right to bring up trivia. And he would just bring up the most amazing trivia. And it was just so funny. You'd be sitting at a table and go, who's the drummer for Spirit? And you go, for who? The group, huh? And he'd give you the name. Then he'd give you the entire history.
Yes.
But that was Mick.
Oh, just think of all of the talk that consists of baseball statistics.
That's Mick.
Or football.
Oh, yeah.
Or hockey.
Matter of fact, I think he wrote a letter to a friend of his, and then he listed his brother's best friends in the sixth grade. Or you'd be sitting around a table and go, you know, it really makes me mad. I can't remember what I had fifth period when I was in eighth grade. And you go, Nick, what are you doing?
Let me tell you, Suzanne, if I could not play 15 minutes of Miss Chitty.
No, Miss Daisy.
I don't have it hand, right? Oh. And I've just worked with this.
Okay. Miss Chitty would be good.
I can't pick it up.
Yeah, okay.
But you want to pour one?
Oh, okay.
Well, let me tell you, I've got the machine in there, and I can't move it, and I have to stop and start.
We can all line up on the couch.
You can sit down. Yeah, just sit down
on the bed.